You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On this month's show, we hear from three wonderful local authors. We talk to Lisa Franson about her new novel, The Shape of Guilt, to Deborah Jenkins about her debut collection of short stories, Winter Light, and to Emma Jackson about her new book, Which You Weren't Here. The Book Club is also available as a podcast, and you can listen to it wherever you listen to yours. If you have a suggestion for the show or want to get in contact, you can follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club or email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. Enjoy the show. Lisa Franson, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Please, can you introduce yourself?
Yes, hi, and thank you. My name is Lisa, and I'm a writer living in Brighton in the southeast of England. And I write in two languages. I write in Swedish for children and in English for adults.
So, although you're Brighton based, like you said, you're originally from Sweden and you write in both Swedish and English. Can you talk a bit about the translation process and what the differences are in writing in each language?
Yes, it's quite interesting, actually, because there is no translation process when I write. It's more like I have two heads, like I have an English head and a Swedish head. So if I'm going to write in English, I put my English head on. And if I write in Swedish, I put my Swedish head on.
That's a great way to think about it. So you are originally a children's author. Can you talk a bit about your children's books and what drew you to retelling folk tales?
Yeah, they're actually two different things. I do write folk tales and fairy tales, but they are more tuned towards adults, and I write them in English. My Swedish books have folkloric elements, but they are completely invented by me. So one is about the fear of dark. I've got one that is about separation and divorce, and one that is about grief and environmental issues, and one that is about bullying.
So you tackle quite hard-hitting subjects in these children's books. How do you kind of strike the balance of being kind of uplifting and positive, but also getting across quite serious messages?
You need to treat children as if they are people. That might sound a bit funny, but I think that's this. Not to talk down to children, you need to be at their level. I always write from the child perspective. I sort of hit my inner 5-year-old or whatever age I'm writing for, and I write from that space. I think also the Swedish children's book culture is very different from the British one. We can write about anything. In fact, I've had some problems with translations just because of this issue, that my book about the fear of dark is too scary for British children, apparently.
that's quite funny. I wonder what that says about us. So you also write short fiction, Lisa. What excites you about short stories?
They are actually, I find them a lot more challenging than to write a novel. You really need to rein your idea in and keep to the theme. There's no room for waffling. There's no room for going off on tangents or exploring other characters. You really need to keep it tight. And it's something I'm still working on. I don't feel I have perfected the short story yet.
You also write flash fiction. What is flash fiction?
It's a good question. I think there are different definitions, definitely. I think most people agree it's for stories under 1,000 words. A lot of competitions have under 250 words, but there are also some that are just 50 words. So it's more of a flash of a story. Like, instead of going into the details, it's like a photograph almost, like an image that tells of a whole bigger world.
So let's move on to The Shape of Guilt. This is your debut novel and out now with Epoch Press. I'd love to know why this novel, after all of your previous books that you've written, and why now?
Why now is because it was accepted now. This is actually the first book. I started writing this 15 years ago. I know this because I wrote it before my son was born, and he's 13 now. So that's when I started writing it. But then, of course, I had to learn how to write. I had to learn how to write in a different language. And then I thought it was finished many times. But of course, there's always more editing to do. And then when I started submitting it, it was obviously hugely difficult and so many rejections. But then I hit on something last year, which meant I actually deleted 2/3 of the book, and then it was accepted.
Wow. So it's a very short novel. How many words is it?
I think it's just around 25,000 words, I think.
So actually it's kind of much more in the space of a novella.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So we would love to hear some. Can you read an extract?
Yes, I will read the first three or so paragraphs. So the first chapter is called What a Morning to Be Alive On. A shriek rips us from our bunny dreams. Our mummy jumps out of her chair and tosses us face down onto the seat. In one beat of her heart, she sprung to your side. Don't you dare, Alex, don't you dare. She slaps your face and shouts. Her heartbeat, always timed to yours, is slowing to a stop. In they come, scraps flapping. One grasps our mummy by the shoulder to steer her out of the room. But she wants to stay, to reach inside you and pull you back from the end of life. The shock of the defibrillator knocks our other body from your bed to the floor. Mummy, you must listen to the nurse. At the sound of our voice, a light switches on in her eyes and she bends down to pick us up. A curt nod at the nurse and she leaves behind your life in their hands. We wait outside in a corridor the length of nightmares. Her locks brush our ears. We catch a faint smell of roses. Soon her legs start to shake and she slides to the floor. The crown of our heads become wet. We are 90% tears.
Thank you so much, Lisa. That's really powerful. So you tackle some pretty dark themes in this book. What are you trying to say with this story?
I was interested in how much we carry that aren't necessarily ours. So I don't for a moment want to suggest that we shouldn't be accountable for our actions, but I think we are sometimes driven and motivated to do things by past events in past generations. This has been, I think there's some research being done this, especially with survivors of Holocaust and their descendants. So I'm interested in sort of this idea of generational trauma, but also, of course, the theme in this book is mental health and about a woman who loses her agency, and essentially she doesn't really know who she's supposed to be, because everyone has a different view of her.
So this is not your average novel, as I've already said. It's very experimental in form. It's quite dreamlike and makes the reader question their own perception of reality. I can imagine that this wasn't an easy book to find a home for. So I'd really like to know about the process of obviously working with Epoch Press, but then kind of working with a smaller publisher too.
We had quite a long conversation before we signed. So I think we were in touch for 3 or 4 years almost before we actually signed for the book. And what happened was I submitted to them, but they also have this e-zine with different themes. So I submitted to their e-zine and they published that. And then I said, I have a novel with you as well. So they took a look at that and they were brilliant. They gave me feedback and I reworked it. And that's sort of how we worked, is they kept giving me feedback. But I think it was only when I myself realized I needed to cut those two first parts that it actually, that they said, yes, this is it.
Yes, that's really good advice actually for any writers, is that to kill your darlings, because mm-hmm. they don't always need to be there. How have you found the reaction been to The Shape of Guilt since it's been published?
And there was such an amazing review published just last week in Interzone magazine by Georgina Bruce, whose writing I respect hugely. And she had really delved into it. It was an in-depth review, and it was nice to see that someone has had understood what I was trying to do and really understood the characters. But I also had a review from a journalist friend that was short and went, wow. So I like that one too.
So what's next for you, Lisa?
I'm working on a second novel that I've been working on in the pauses, so to speak, while this has been off for review and various other processes. So I have a novel I've been working on for 12 years on the side of this one, which is very different to this one. I'm hoping to finish that by Christmas to send it off to my agent and see what she thinks.
And how can we find and follow you, Lisa, and keep up to date with all of your work?
I'm on Instagram and on Facebook and on TikTok as Lisa Lee Franson. So I'm quite easy to find there.
Deborah Jenkins, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Please, can you introduce yourself?
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me on the show. So my name is Deborah Jenkins. I'm an author. I'm also a freelance writer and a part-time primary school teacher, and I live in Uckfield, so maybe about 40 minutes from Brighton.
Your collection of short stories, Winter Lights, is out now with Fairlight Press. Can you tell us about this collection?
So Winter Lights is a series of short stories based around the festive season, so in the run-up to Christmas and New Year. And it kind of explores that whole sometimes very emotionally charged time of year from lots of different perspectives. So from the point of view of an old lady, of a single guy, of a woman trying to juggle various work roles and family roles, of a child. So lots of different perspectives on that whole time of year, which I think for many of us can be a really wonderful time of year, you know, to get together with family and friends and celebrate the whole community feel at the darkest time of year. But actually, it can also be very difficult because lots of people have suffered loss or various other challenges at time of year, and memories of childhood, good or bad. And I think these can sometimes really affect the way that we approach the festive season.
What's your relationship with the festive season like?
Well, I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with it, to be honest, for lots of reasons. I mean, I'm part of a clergy family, so church has always been a big thing. So the faith side of it, you know, is important for me personally. And I really love the whole family side. My children are grown up now and independent. They all come back. We get together with a wider family. So I really love that side of Christmas. And I do really love all the traditions, you know, associated with Christmas that I was brought up with, you know, choosing and buying presents, making special food, that kind of thing. But yes, you know, I've experienced difficult times at Christmas in years gone by, you know, a close family member who was basically the end of his life, my dad actually. And I've had various health problems in the past over Christmas. And also it can be a very stressful time, you know, because it's so busy. And somebody who, you know, whose husband is involved with church life very heavily, and I'm a primary teacher. In the past, yeah, when I had kids at home myself, it could be absolutely crazy. And sometimes I think, you know, I actually think it's some kind of punishment. I don't really want to be doing this. So I have very, very mixed feelings about it.
So this collection will appeal to people who have like a really wide range of emotions and feelings about the festive period.
I think so. Yes, I think it will, because the main message of the book, I would say, is that Christmas can be wonderful and it can be terrible. But, you know, it's at times in a way when one's struggling, I think, that it's the small things like, you know, a smile from a stranger or an unexpected gift from a child or something very small can bring a bit of light and hope, you know, when we most need it. And I mean, we all need that all the time. Excuse me. But I think at Christmas, those little things are even more important.
Can you talk a bit, Deborah, please, about your journey to publication? How did this collection go from initial idea to being published?
So I've always wanted to write a book of short stories. And I've often thought it would be fun to write one based on the festive season. And I do like reading short stories around Christmas time. partly because I'm very busy and I don't have time to sit down and read whole novels. But I was told years and years ago, actually, that nobody's going to publish a book of short stories by, you know, an unknown writer. So I moved on to other things. And then last year, my debut novel, Braver, came out with Fairlight Books, which was, again, a book that I had been wanting to write for a while on a very different theme, which I, in fact, wrote during lockdown because I was very vulnerable and couldn't teach at that time, health-wise. And that was eventually accepted by Fairlight Books. So after that book was published, it went on to be nominated for a couple of awards, which was, you know, amazing, incredible. And then I thought, well, maybe Fairlight would consider publishing a book of short stories for me, because I knew that they publish short stories. So I sent off two or three to them and they liked them. And then they went on to publish the whole collection.
So as you said, this collection follows from your novel called Braver. How different is the process of writing a novel and writing short stories?
Well, that's a really interesting question, actually. I think for me, personally, I feel like I'm more of a natural short story writer. And I found the process of writing a novel very different and very challenging, because you have to work a lot harder at padding out different characters. You know, your story arc needs to be a lot longer and deeper. And the whole process of plotting and planning is a lot more complicated. I'm not a natural plotter. I'm more of a pantser. So I tend to kind of write and then things happen. And then I start planning, because I go back and I think, well, if I want that to happen, then I'll have to have this happen earlier on. So that whole process I found very, very challenging, because that's not my natural personality to plan my writing quite like that. Where with a short story, you can kind of write and see what happens up to a point. Obviously, you do need to plan at some point. So, yes, I think I found the short story is much easier to write.
Can you read some of this collection, please?
Yes, of course. So I'm going to read part of a short story from one called Once Did Orla Davis. And this story is from the perspective of child. So the story is called Once Did Orla Davis. Jesus is looking cranky. No one else sees this, cooing and smiling at him in admiration. But Tyler does, because he notices things. As the line of hopping children files past the stable scene, he brings his face up very close. Yep, cranky as hell. That's what his mum always says about his sister when she looks that way. Forehead creased, mouth turned down, rigid arms with fist balls. Perhaps his nappy needs changing, or he's hungry, or he's in a bad mood for being born. Mum says that about Elsie when she's cranky. She's in a bad mood for being born. Tyler likes to hear the story because he comes out of it well. Elsie was late, so they inducted her, or was it infused? And even then, she took ages to come, and in the end, the doctor had to hoover her out with a vacuum thing. Whereas Tyler, Mum would ruffle his hair fondly at this point, came out bang on time, with little fuss and no tearing. He doesn't really know what that means, but it must be something to do with not ripping in two. So when he told Orla Davis, she squeaked and shouted, "It's to do with your mum, not you, numbskull. Ask her." But he hasn't. He likes the story the way it is. It cheers him up when he's feeling cross with Elsie, when it feels like she sucks up all the love in the house, leaving a space where his should be. When Mum tells the story, he feels special. He stares at the Virgin Mary, pressing his face up close to the crib, wondering if Jesus had done it without tearing. Mary gazes back at him calmly. She's not at all like his mum, he thinks, with her smooth skin, covered hair and patient expression. His mum has freckles and springy curls, which she runs through her hands. She rushes around all day saying things like, "Hell's bells," and "For Pete's sake," unless she sits down. Then she falls promptly asleep. She never used to be like this before Elsie was born. But babies make you crazy, especially at 6 months old. This is what he's noticed, particularly if you have a husband who works away and a farty dog. He stares glumly at Jesus, all small and cranky in his wooden crib, and then at his adoring parents. Joseph is on the edge of things, behind a shepherd. Tyler reaches out grubby fingers and moves him closer to Jesus. He gives the baby a secret nod. At least your dad's here, he tells him. Mine probably won't be back till Christmas Eve. He'll miss the carols. Again. He sighs and pulls his head back away from the stable scene. But when he turns round, the line is gone. At the other end of the parish church, the rest of the class are jostling for places in the choir stalls. He makes to run and join them. But Miss Flack is standing in front of him, hands on hips. What do you think you're doing, Tyler Ferguson? Her face is red and her mouth working furiously. Did I actually see you touch him? Sorry, miss, touch who? Tyler glances round. He often gets in trouble for touching people, but there's no one around. He squints up at the teacher. She's standing in a fall of light from the stained glass window, her face a patchwork of coloured squares. He imagines pushing her over, face first, into the paint box he got for his birthday. He bats the thought away. Miss Flack grows taller. She is thin with big hair, a furious isosceles triangle. They've just done shape in maths, and Tyler is pleased he can remember this. She looms over him, and he steps back into the crib scene. It wobbles dangerously. Stand still! He freezes. I have told you, she shouts, countless times, not to touch. Tyler lifts his chin and tries to look at her. He's scared of her, they all are, and he can't quite bring himself to meet her eye. He says nothing. There is no point. Miss Flack hates him. This is because he never gets things right. Somehow he gets the wrong end of the stick, misunderstands, doesn't listen. Miss Flack teaches them when their teacher is away, which horrifyingly is all the time now, as Mrs. James is in critical care. At least that's what it said in the school newsletter. Tyler knows the word criticised from the Year 5-6 spelling list, but can't work out why it's being used for lovely Mrs. James. She went in for a hard-top. Also, she's so kind, he can't imagine her criticising anyone, especially those caring for her. But there you are. It is one of life's mysteries.
Thank you so much, Deborah. That is absolutely charming. You can really tell how your work as a primary school teacher has influenced this story in particular. Are there books that you really love teaching your students?
That's interesting. Yes, I think probably my work as a primary school teacher has influenced the way I write, because I think children show life's kind of raw, most raw emotions without any kind of attempt to hide them. You know, they haven't learned how to hide how they really feel about things. So when you're teaching young children, I think you kind of witness human nature in its sort of simplest form, if you like. And I just find that really, really inspiring, you know, because we're all basically children. We've just learned how to maybe monitor and hide our emotions in different ways. And, you know, you can see in children that we all need the same things, you know, to feel loved, to feel valued, to feel accepted, to feel significant, you know. Pick me, you know, everybody wants to feel significant, wants to feel noticed, and wants to be part of something. When you watch children in the playground, you know, they're so desperate to be part of something. Then you get those children who confidently walk away on their own, singing quietly, really not caring, you know, and it's fascinating to see the sort of whole spectrum of human nature. As far as books that I love teaching my children, these days I work in small groups with Year 6 children, just preparing them for their SATs. So I'm not really teaching books anymore.
So, Deborah, I'd love to know what your experience has been like working with a small press. I know Fairlight Books don't publish that many books a year, and they spend time and care kind of on each one.
Yes.
What's your experience been?
Well, I've had a really positive experience. They've been a delight to work with. The wonderful thing about working with an independent publisher is you have that direct relationship. You know, you email them and then they always reply promptly. You feel that you're more involved with the whole process of publication because you kind of know what stage you're at with the editing and what's happening next. they want to have a personal relationship with their authors. And I think perhaps when, I don't know for sure because I've never been published by, you know, a big publisher, but I imagine that that's much harder, for purely practical reasons. When you're working with a big publisher, obviously you have to have an agent to work with a big publisher anyway, so probably most of it goes through the agent. So working directly with an indie publisher, I've really loved. It's been a really positive experience, and that's why I wanted to ask Fairlight if they would publish another book for me, because I've really enjoyed the relationship and found it to be a very positive thing.
So this book comes with a Spotify playlist. What made you decide to do this, and how important is music to you and your writing?
Well, I wrote the book during the summer months, which was very interesting because obviously it's quite hard to sort of describe Christmassy atmospheres when you're experiencing really warm weather. So I was trying very hard to kind of create atmosphere in one of the stories, and I thought, I know, maybe I'll listen to Christmas music. So I put on some of my favourite things that I like to listen at Christmas. And it really helped, you know, it really kind of got me in the groove, as it were. So I wrote the stories and submitted them, and Fairlight accepted them. And then I just had this really wacky thought. I thought, I wonder if, you know, we should actually suggest the playlist or have some kind of link to the playlist in the book. So I asked my editor what she thought about it, and they went away and discussed it. And they came back and they said, you know what, we really like that idea. Never done it before, but why not? Let's have a go. And that was so lovely. And that's another reason why I love working with an independent publisher. You know, you have that personal relationship, and they were prepared to consider this rather wacky idea. So they went away and they organised it for me. So there's a link in the digital version, and in the paperback version, it's just a list of the songs. I think if any music, you know, as a writer, as a creative, listening to music is something that always helps me to get my imaginative juices going. I don't usually, I'm perhaps of that generation where I find it hard to concentrate on something if I've got music in the background. I can't really do that. But I love to listen to it, you know, to kind of get my imagination going. I sit in the study, it looks over and trees in a nature reserve, and listen to the music, the ideas come, and I stop the music and I write. And I do find that a very, very inspiring thing.
So Deborah, you have been shortlisted for the Society of Authors' ADCI Literary Prize and the Best First Novel Award. What impact did this have on your writing and in your confidence?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think one of the main things was my confidence. You know, I've been writing for many years and trying to get published for many years. And then I hit 60 and I thought, well, that's not going to happen. And then I got a publishing contract. And then I was shortlisted for these two awards. So it was an incredible experience, actually, Anna. It felt a bit surreal. I mean, I couldn't actually believe it, first of all. And then, you know, going to these two red carpet events with my husband, you know, dressed up all smart, and seeing people like Bonnie Garmus and Joanna Harris and Val McDermott, and thinking, oh my goodness, I had a huge sense of imposter syndrome to begin with. But it really, really did my confidence so much good. And I feel like it was an affirmation that I should consider, you know, pouring the next few years into my writing. You know, we never know how long we've got, do we? And I'm a late starter, very late starter, but I only teach a few hours a week now. So I am in a position where I can really go for my writing. And I think those two shortlistings did a massive thing for my confidence, thinking, well, you know, why not? Some people at least like what I've written. So yeah, keep going, Deborah. You're not too old yet.
Never too old. So you are a writer living in Sussex, Uckfield, as you said at the top of this chat. How does the Sussex setting impact your writing, and what is your writing community like here?
Oh, well, that's, yeah, the countryside is a huge inspiration to me. We moved here 5 years ago from South London, essentially for my husband's job, actually, although also to live near his parents to help care for them. And just being out here, you know, in the woods and the fields, it is hugely inspiring for me. And just looking out of the window and going out for a walk, I find, you know, if I get stuck in a story, I can just go and walk in the nature reserve and let my mind wander, and ideas will just drop into my head like stones, and that never happens in London. And of course, there's the seaside. All of that is the coast. We quite often go to Seaford. That's our nearest seaside resort, and I just find all of that really, really helpful. What was the second part of the question?
What is your community, your writing community like?
Right. So I have a online writing community that I started developing in London. A group of people who we talk frequently, exchange ideas, you know, ask each other for advice and help. Part of that's through Twitter, part of it's through Facebook. I also have a very good friend who, in fact, is also published with Fairlight Books, Sarah Butler, who wrote a fantastic book called Starling, and she doesn't live very far away from me. But interestingly enough, we met on Twitter and then saw that we were both in East Sussex and made contact. And now we meet regularly for coffee and chats and inspirational talks. I think the writing community thing is massively important, isn't it? And whether it's online or, you know, a local community group, it's really something that helps us to build that network, you know, and also to have people to turn to when things are going badly, and things do often go badly in writing.
What are you working on next, Deborah?
So I have just started planning a new book, which at the moment, working title, Hearing Loss. I'm severely deaf. I'm also partially sighted, actually. But the book is really going to be, although it will have a character with actual hearing loss, it's going to be more about the whole idea that as a human race, I think we've lost the ability to listen, you know, to ourselves, to our own emotions, to the world, to what the world is telling us to do and not to do to it. And I think this whole idea of hearing loss intrigues me because it can be relevant on so many levels, not just as somebody who's lost their physical hearing, but in many, many other ways. I think we can lose the ability to listen. So it's going to be exploring that really. It's in the very early stages, Anna, and I can't really tell you much more about it yet because, as I say, I'm a pantser. So one day, hopefully, if you ever have me back, I will.
And how can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of your lovely new book?
Well, I'm on Twitter, at Lover of Hats. So I'd love you to follow me there. I'm on Instagram as Deborah Jenkins dot still wondering. I write a blog called stillwonderinghere.net, in which I pontificate about all the weird and crazy things that happen to us in life. And my book is available from, well, I'd love you to get it from a local bookshop. In fact, Kemp Town Bookshop would be great. They're selling the books at my launch, which is going to be in Uckfield Library. Or, you know, in all the usual places, Waterstones, and online in all the usual places.
Thank you very much. Winter Lights is out now with Fairlight Books. Brighton-based romance writer Emma Jackson is back on the Brighton Book Club to tell us about her new book, Which You Weren't Here, which is out now with Orion. Emma, welcome back and congratulations. Can you tell us about this new book?
Thank you. Oh, it's lovely to be back. So basically, this is another romantic comedy, but this one has a magical twist to it, as I'm sure you can tell from the title. It's basically Planes, Trains and Automobiles meets the X-Hex. Yeah, so it's a road trip novel. Kay is a witch whose magic is misbehaving, and she's gone to Prague to see like a witch expert to try and help her with that. But when she's there, a hurricane hits, and getting back for her brother's wedding becomes a lot more difficult. And she also happens to bump into Harry, who was her teenage crush who broke her heart 10 years ago, and they are forced to travel back together. So it's heavy on forced proximity, second chance romance, and it was real fun to write, and hopefully it'll be very fun to read.
I bet it was so fun to write. Why now do you think you've decided to bring magic and kind of witchcraft into your romances after writing more kind of straight romances previously?
Well, I've always loved fantasy. It's, you know, it's always been, and fantasy romance. And actually I was myself and a friend run a fantasy romance podcast called the SFF Romcast. And we've been doing that since about 2021, I think. We met also through the Romantic Novelists Association when we both volunteered to be the admins for the online chapter, the fantasy online chapter. And at the time, it was actually really quite hard in the UK to find a publishing home for anything that was fantasy romance. It was like that publishers didn't really feel like they could find a place to sell it. So they were very cagey about taking it on. But that kind of changed quite a lot. I think the advent of TikTok and seeing the boom in sort of how many readers are actually out there and love it. So I think that's kind of changed it. So it was more a case of I'd always been ready for it. It was just that publishers were now ready for it too. So that was really, really nice timing, I think.
Absolutely. So romanticy is quite a new buzzword in the industry. Mm-hmm. So for anyone who's not sure, really, me included, what does a romanticy contain? What are the tropes?
Well, I think with romanticy, I think that is kind of, I think they're aiming for something that is what you would expect from a fantasy novel in terms of a very otherworld, the excitement, you know, high stakes in terms of, you know, a threat of some kind. And then usually the romance element coming in when, you know, the characters, whichever pairings they might be, come together against that and have to, and it, I think the balance is more of a 50-50 balance between the romance and the fantasy, as opposed to a fantasy with a romantic subplot, which can happen quite a lot, and those are great too. So I think romanticy, that phrase, is being applied to those type of books, but also there's been a big boom in cozy fantasy, and I think romance is finding a place in that too, you know, like much lower stakes and things like, particularly with like a witchy rom-com, there's quite a lot of those around, and you tend to find they're based in like smaller communities. There's quite that feel there, a very comforting, homey feel. I mean, you know, romances still always cover important subjects, I think, you know, that are important to people, relationships, but it's just got that little magical twist to it too.
Can you read some for us?
Yes, sure. So this extract is from the Meet Cute later on when they're in Prague. The clamour of bells rang out, some loud, some small chimes, and the crowd exclaimed in delight. Kay couldn't let herself get distracted. Maybe another time. It would be nice to visit, to get a guidebook and look up the history. But not now. She gave the map on her phone one last check, zipped it away and took the handle of her suitcase again. The weight of it made it feel a bit like trying to do a three-point turn in a monster truck. It teetered off the small curb and she stepped down too, turning to straighten it before she set off. Only, as she tried to pivot back towards the main square, her leg didn't come with her. She tugged. Tugged again. The heel of her boot was caught in the small groove between two cobbles. This was because she wished she could stay, wasn't it? Her magic had taken the opportunity to weld her heel into the ground. Want to stay? Here's a perfect excuse, it was saying. You're welcome. Kay let go of her suitcase entirely to pull at the spiked heel. Momentarily, she wished she could just blast it with a shot of telekinetic magic or send a little magical lubrication its way. But no, No magic for her, witch doctor's orders. In her current panic, she'd probably end up with an exploded suitcase, the street littered with marketing brochure confetti, while she was escorted to the nearest police station. She glanced up, as though the solution might be found somewhere else, and saw the little skeleton figure on the closest corner of the clock, ringing its tiny golden bell. If that wasn't a cosmic message that time was a-ticking, she didn't know what was. Right, push was coming to shove. She was going to have to take the boot off. On the plus side, at least she had other shoes in her suitcase, and if she had to snap the heel off her boot to free it, she could always mend it, or get it mended by someone who wasn't magically impaired. Taking off her tote so it didn't smack her in the head as she bent over to unzip the knee-high boot, she tucked it between her and the suitcase. Now the show on the clock was over, the cloud were dispersing, and she had to keep her hands on both bags, apologising for getting in the way of people walking by and simultaneously making sure no one stole her stuff. She'd just have to wait until the crowd had cleared. Someone jostled her from the side and she wobbled, forced to crouch to avoid toppling over and breaking her ankle. Frustration bubbled up inside of her, her cheeks growing hot. "Are you okay?" Kay's heart did a strange tumble as she heard a man speaking from just behind her, the huskiness of his voice familiar. But no, it couldn't be. She was in Prague, not Bidicott, or London, or wherever he lived now, and her luck couldn't be that bad, could it? "Can I help you?" A pair of white trainers with a big rainbow night tick on the side that looked like it was dripping paint to the soles came into view. And then he was crouching beside her, and she was looking up, feeling like it was happening in slow motion. "Kay, is that really you?" Yes, it was her, and apparently it really was Harry Ashworth too. Her luck was that bad.
Oh, I love a good meet cute. I love romance. Why did you decide, Emma, to set some of this in Prague? Does it have a special significance to you?
I've not been to Prague myself, but the other countries that they have to travel across, Germany, and they go to Amsterdam as well on their long route to get home, I have been to. But my partner had been to Prague not long before. And when I was doing some of the research into sort of the magical elements and folklore and things like that, I mean, I love reading some of the folklore that comes from Eastern European areas and stuff. It kind of came together for that. So obviously that's in the Old Town Square with the astronomical clock, which is featured on the front of my book cover as well. And I love that they picked that out because it just felt right in terms of having that time element, because it's very much a story that's against the clock as they're trying to get home too. So it kind of brought everything together. It looks like a beautiful place. I'd really love to go.
It does. Yes, me too. So I would love to know what romances through your life have inspired you. So these might be kind of real life romances. They might be films or books or poetry. Like, what really feeds into your writing?
Oh gosh. Yeah. Oh, that's a tough question. the romances that have inspired me. I've always loved romances. I think when I was younger, we really used to enjoy watching kind of that. There's kind of like this golden age of like 90s rom-coms that used to be on, you know, like Bridget Jones and Sleepless in Seattle and things like that, While You Were Sleeping. They're these really fun romances with like lovely characters and just that sense of optimism. They were really, really, I think they're quite inspirational in terms of how my taste has gone with following that. I mean, I do love love stories that are a little bit more tragic too, but I can't bring myself to write those necessarily. I always like the happily ever after or the happily for now. So yeah, and I mean, and personally, I'm very lucky. I've met my partner when I was quite young, and we've been together a long time. And I think that loving romance, but also understanding what it is to be in a very long-term relationship, so that realistic side of what it takes to you know, to keep compromising and keep growing alongside each other, I think that's definitely an inspiration for it too.
So what's the reaction been to the book? It's been out for a couple of weeks now. And I just had a quick scan on some of the reviews and they are so lovely.
Yeah, I've been blown away. It's been really, really nice because obviously it's a little bit of a sidestep in terms of genre, not completely, but yeah, so far, so good. Definitely. I'm hearing some lovely things. Just this morning, I had someone tag me in an Instagram saying how much they loved it and that they were going to recommend it to everybody to read, which is like the best thing to hear when you're a writer. That's like the best kind of advertising or marketing you can get, really. So far, yeah, really, really lovely to hear. I think people are enjoying the fun of it, but also the second chance element, because I think where it's a second chance romance, it's not just the romance, which is also a second chance. There's also kind of a thing for Kay with a second chance at coming to embrace her magic and the problems she's got with family and things like that.
So what are your top tips for anyone that thinks I'd really like to write a romance novel, but they're not quite sure where to start?
Oh, right. Definitely. You've got to read the romance a lot, and enjoy it. Find out what it is you enjoy about it, I think is probably the main thing. For me, I also think that romance is very character-led. So I think if your reader they don't necessarily always have to love your character, but they have to be interested in your character. But I think in romance, there is a little bit more of that comfort element that, you know, they trying not to frustrate the reader with decisions your character makes is quite a difficult one. So I think with romance, definitely try and make sure that the decisions you're making are not for not to force characters into certain situations, but to get them there in a way that seems logical. You know, is that phrase of kill your darlings is what that kind of applies to. You can really, really want to write that scene where the characters are somewhere and they're doing something because it's been in your head the whole time, but once you've started writing, it just might not fit where the story's going. So always serve the characters truly and serve the story truly, and I think your readers will come along with you then.
That is great advice. And I'd love to know a bit, Emma, about your journey to publication and what that looked like. How long did you write before you got published and how did you get there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I always wrote from when I was tiny. But in terms of writing and thinking that I was going to try to actually get a book published, probably took me about 6 years, I think. I was writing, I'd written two novels, and then I wrote the third one, which was my debut novel. In fact, it was longer than that. No, probably 10 years and 6 years for what was to become my debut novel. Because I was writing that in and around having my kids. So I was very much like whenever I could spare the time through sleepless nights and things like that. So yeah, it took quite a long time. But I think when I'd had my second daughter, that was when I really decided like I need to stop playing at it and just like really, really focus, because you know it won't happen unless you make it happen, sort of thing. Yeah, there's that saying that the only way you know it definitely won't happen, the fear of rejection, is if you don't try at all. So it was getting to that point and going, right, I'm gonna really go for it. And I joined the RNA in their new writers scheme, and I was in that for a year, and then I got picked up. Yeah,
and that's the Romantic Novelist Association.
Yes, Romantic Novelist Association.
So Emma, what is next for you? What can we look forward to?
Well, I've got I'm contracted for two books, so I'm writing the second book at the moment, and that is set in the same world as Which You Weren't Here, but it will be a different couple. You will probably have cameos from some of the characters from Which You Weren't Here, but it will be a separate romance. And then I'm not sure. I'm very excited. I've just signed with an agent, Beth from the Kate Nash Literary Agency, and spoken to her about lots of different projects, and she loves fantasy and romance too, so we're very excited about where it might be heading next. So I'm not entirely sure after the second book's out, but yeah, watch this space.
Well, congratulations again, and for anybody that wants to buy Which You Weren't Here, which is probably easier to buy than it is to say, it is out now and available from all good bookshops. Emma, how can we find and follow you?
So I'm on the social media platform that was formerly known as Twitter, X now, TikTok, Instagram. I'm Emma S. Jackson 1 on those. I also have my website, which you can go to, which is esjackson.co.uk, sorry. And you can also sign up to my newsletter through that, and you should be able to find my link to my podcast as well.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
If you love a book event as much as I do, I thought I would let you know about a few things that are going on at the Kemptown Bookshop in Brighton. So on the 2nd of November, we have an event called The Long History of Women's Football with Carrie Dunn. So Carrie is going to talk about the long history of women's football, including why it was effectively banned in the 1920s and called quite unsuitable for females right up to its glorious present and looking at its excited future. Her book is called Women Up, Pitches, Pay and Periods, The Progress and Potential of Women's Football. Then on the 9th of November, there is an author Q&A titled The Value of Everyday Encounters with artist and writer Andy Field, as he talks about the value of everyday human encounters and the value of our in-person interactions with people in the world around us. Andy is the author of Encounterism, The Neglected Joy of Being in Person. And on the 16th of November at 7 p.m, we have an event called Hockney, A Graphic Guide. Join Kemptown Books for an illuminating illustrated talk that follows the journey of David Hockney's exceptional life through a graphic novel style biography written and illustrated by Simon Elliott. All of these events are free and take place at the Kemptown Bookshop. Thank you for listening. Our next show is my favourite one of the year. It's our bumper Christmas recommendation special with my friend and bookseller at Daunt Books, Elizabeth Perry. I love recording this show so much. It just gives me so much joy, and it really sets me up with a really good reading list for the year. So if you haven't heard it before, the way that we do it is we go through the top five bestsellers in fiction and non-fiction, and then Elizabeth offers her best alternative recommendations for books that you might not necessarily have heard of. It's a really great way to find out what's selling really well, but also a really good way to kind of work out what to buy people if they liked a certain thing. We will also be joined by Idra Novi, which is really exciting, and Idra is the author of the next book club book, Take What You Need, which is one of the recommendations from Elizabeth and is out now with Daunt Books. I've actually already read this one, I've just finished it, and I can tell you it is completely brilliant and unlike anything I've ever read, actually. Sculpture is a big part of it, and I never thought I'd enjoy a book where sculpture plays such an important role. So here's the blurb to whet your appetite. Take What You Need traces the parallel lives of Jean and her beloved but estranged stepdaughter, Leah, who sought a clean break from her rural childhood. In Leah's urban life with her young family, she's revealed little about Jean, how much she misses her stepmother's hard-won insights and joyful lack of inhibition. But with Jean's death, Leah must return to sort through what's been left behind. What Leah discovers is staggering. Jean has filled her ramshackle house with giant sculptures she's welded from scraps of the area's industrial history. Set in the mountains of Appalachia, Take What You Need explores the continuing mystery of the people we love most, zeroing in on the joys and difficulties of family with great verve and humour, and illuminating what can be built from what others have discarded. I cannot wait to talk to the author of this book. It's absolutely beautifully written. I love a dual narrative and it's really, really thought-provoking. Yeah, I really, really would highly recommend it. So if you can, grab a copy from your local bookshop, preferably your independents, and read ahead of the show. Don't forget to subscribe to the Brighton Book Club podcast, where you can catch up on over 50 episodes of the show. If you like what you hear, do rate and review and tell your book-loving friends. It really makes a difference. I am leaving you now with music from one of Brighton's finest musicians and one of the people I've known longest in the world, Morrissey, with his new song Borders. You can follow him on all platforms at Morrissey Music, that's spelled M-R-I-S-I Music, and go and see him next time he plays. We will be back.
In their eyes, they'll lock you up and they'll break you, but I know you're gonna be alright.
At the border, my love, good luck at the border, my love, at the border, my love.